German invasion continues to advance north and west. Swindon, Oxford.
Yes, there it is. My name's Captain Wolfram. We've established an observation post in this valley.
We'll be here for a week, perhaps two.
Is your husband at home, Mrs. Lewis?
The civilian must do nothing which would be of slightest help to the enemy.
I appreciate your concerns. Whether your government forbids your cooperation or not is entirely irrelevant. This valley is now under German control.
Why hasn't he said anything about the man?
He knows. It's enough.
We don't even know where they are.
I got the flock to look after, the pigs, the slates on the barn to fix.
You know what happens to collaborators, Maggie, do you?
The adaptation from book to a screenplay, How difficult did you find that?
Theme is certainly very important to the novel, and you're right, you know, that's sort of very much sort of working in a poet's territory, and not just theme, but also symbolism. For both the film and for the novel, I feel that from the moment the German patrol enter the valley, that for me, you know, the volume on the symbolism of the story is sort of turned up a few degrees. But I'd argue that actually the novel has a great deal of plot, actually. So it's interesting, because if that's being judged from the film, then it would suggest that the film has actually brought out those themes.
Which I think is harder to do.
Yeah.
I think that's why we're trying to do that.
Which is awesome. Great, because actually what happened in that process of adaptation was sort of, it went the other way around, to which I think it often goes, which I loved, was that we did move more towards theme and towards tone, which, as Amit said, is a very difficult thing to adapt. And we actually moved away from some of the plot complications of the novel. But to answer the question, I suppose the most important thing I should say is that this was a screenplay that was actually co-written between us. And I think that's a crucial point, because that wasn't always the case. I mean, to start off with, Amit asked if he could make this his first feature, and I was thrilled. And we started to talk about the story in the book. And I generally can't remember who suggested it first, but it felt very natural that we should work on it together. And the thing that I responded to was that Amit started off talking about wanting to respond to the tone, to the lyricism, and I think something he said is sort of extracting three or four of the major themes and making these the sort of central planks of the adaptation.
There was an atmosphere in the novel that I thought we should try and capture in the film. I respond to films that try and do that. They feel more timeless to me. I wanted it to have a contemporary resonance, and I think it's easier to do that if it's thematic rather than plot driven. And there's something about the tone that we talked about very early on, and that's kind of what we tried to do through the adaptation into the style of the way the film shot. I mean, it was very conscious from our first conversations about adapting it for film.
This is your first feature.
It is, yeah.
How did you go down this road? Because again, with the research I was able to do, it's not like you have a long list of TV credits leading up to this.
No. It's a hell of a first film to try and do. I mean, if you've got a list of things first-time filmmakers should probably try and avoid to do in terms of getting a film set up, you'd avoid a period film, you'd avoid children, you'd avoid anything that's involving the war. You'd avoid remote locations. All these things that are challenging, and the kind of schedule we had, which was extremely challenging. I really wanted to make this film, and maybe that came across to people I pitched it to, but I really felt there was something that I felt I could do, and you know, that's pretty much it.
The film is set in winter, which you need that catalyst of the first heavy snow to bring the Germans into the community. Yeah. But were you careful not to film this beautiful landscape beautifully?
Yes, absolutely. The landscape needs to look like an unforgiving place in some ways, because I always had the sense that the men, these men who've gone, if they have gone into the mountains or the hills, where you see them disappear off to, that they know this terrain, but it's a terrain that you have to know. And actually, if you know, when the captain experiences the snow, the thing he remembers is being in Siberia. He doesn't walk through a valley full of flowers and suddenly think, I want to stay here. It's the connection, the association of the snow and the harshness of what he's left behind that means he doesn't want to leave and can't leave. But it's that that reminds him of what war is.
I wondered if, and again this might be just barking up the wrong tree, but the captain states to Sarah, the female character, that he has a history in medieval studies.
Yeah.
Is that just simply a plot device so we can explain what the map is? Or is it also there because he thinks this sort of feudal society that he knows will actually work?
In terms of the film, why it's so important is because he doesn't reveal the information of the map because the map means something to him.
Hmm.
It reminds him of the man he was because it just takes him back to a previous time. It takes him back to the time when he was a student. And when he says, you know, the map's more important than all of us, he means that. He means that state, what the map represents, you know, culture, civilization, that world is way more important than what's going on there.
But the map has a double purpose, surely, and it mirrors the ledger that Sarah, that Andrew Riseborough character keeps in the house.
Is
that the map is the world as we knew it at that time.
Absolutely.
And the ledger is the world as they know it.
Yes.
And these farmers' wives who bring the Germans into their farms are sort of happy to do that because the world they know is more important than the nation that's lost. And both the map and the ledger mirror that sentiment, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, actually, one of the most important lines in the film is when Sarah asks him what this map is, and he says it's the world, or at least an idea of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the intellectual and the moral conflict that happens at the close of the film is around the idea of worlds, and at what point do we accept that the idea of world has changed and therefore we have to change with it? I mean, when Sarah writes in her ledger, she's writing a representation of the world. She's not mentioning...
No, but it's the same as drawing a new river on the map.
Exactly. This is absolutely, you know, and that's why, you know, when Albert looks at the map and he points out, you know, the four letters that spell out death and says, you know, everything outside of God's creation is death. Absolutely, he's imprinting this idea upon the valley itself as well. Yeah, and you know, as Amit said, I think the map is an important sort of symbolic document on many, many levels. But in terms of the film, it's the intellectual property over which he tries to show Sarah the man he was before he was a soldier, and over which he tries to intellectually seduce her. Really,
there will come a time when people will just want this to stop. Anything. They'll just want to survive.
Tyler!
But what we have to ask ourselves is, how do we want to survive? What is worth surviving for?
Sarah, we must leave.
You know I can't leave.
But if you stay now, then you'll die.
It is the choices that we make that will decide the nature of our resistance, the nature of our survival. Our choices will be the mark of who we are.
I want to talk about Michael Sheen. It's a small role which will take some audiences by surprise, but outside your previous relationship with him, because you worked on The Passion. Was his presence in the film to give weight to a role that needs weight, but there isn't the time to write or have it in the film?
For me, I'd been working with Michael Sheen. We've been talking about the character of Atkins an awful lot. We realised that the film, as you know, most films do, required a speech at its heart that said, actually, this is what, you know, if you had to hold what this film is about in your hand. We wanted to give that speech to Atkins, and it was as simple as, I was working with Michael, he's a fantastic actor, and we just said, if Michael Sheen could say that speech, that would be incredible.
But it was also the part. I mean, to me, the part is really important. To me, it's the contemporary, the contemporary reference is somebody who recruits suicide bombers.
I want to come to this for a different way. The speech that we get a flashback to, where he tells the one member of the resistance who has punished somebody in the village for collaboration, supposed collaboration, is that the speech that he gives it, that there will be a time when the villagers, when the community just want to give up, want to accept that this new order is, just get on with their daily lives.
Yeah, he's talking...
And he's stressing that this is wrong. Now, that's interesting in and of itself, and I might be wrong here, but I'm sure the establishing shot of the young lad who's a member of the resistance is of a church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the character, I don't think it's made clear, and again, I might be missing something, that I don't think that he's a pastor or a member of the community.
No, he's not.
But they might simply be meeting in the church. But is that speech coupled to that establishing shot of the church deliberate, or is it simply it was a nice shot to open?
No, it's absolutely deliberate. But I mean, but this is interesting because, you know, what we were trying to do was say the lines between occupation, collaboration, everything becomes blurred. What people have to do in those situations is incredibly complicated and maybe morally unjustifiable, but sometimes, you know, perhaps we are saying in some way that the ends justify the means, you know.
Yes, but everybody else, every other decision in the film is made in the heat of the moment, as awful as it is, and we might discuss that. But his speech is cold.
Yeah.
So that to me makes him the worst character in it, because he knows what he's doing, whilst the other characters don't, to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree to that to a point. I think some of the other characters do know what they're doing. I mean, something that interests me in writing the book and in the adaptation is that the one constant in all war is the exploitation of youth, you know, quite often by sort of ideological elders. So, you know, Steiner, you know, the younger soldier in the patrol who we assume is more kind of, you know, Hitler youth, he's sort of the person who brings the whole pack of cards down by going out and radioing in the same way. I'm aware that we can't sort of broadcast all of this, you know, but George, who is recruited by Michael Sheen's character, also, you know, contributes to breaking that brief utopia. And what they have in common is that they are, in a way, exploited by their elders. The roots of Michael Sheen's speech, I mean, they actually sort of lie very much in the real ethos of the real sort of British resistance movement, which was partly so controversial because it would have split the country, it would have split the war cabinet, because there is one argument to say that once the British government has officially surrendered, then the job of the administration is to reduce civilian casualties. And if that means rooting out the resistance, then it is. But then there was the resistance that said, actually, we must continue at all costs. And it's those last words which are so questionable and so interesting, which you hope sends people away with questions. What does at all costs mean?
You're also interested in, judging from the actions of the German captain, of Albrecht, that even he starts with honourable intent, within reason, he starts with honourable intentions. Well, he certainly doesn't want to cause any more violence.
No. Yeah.
But obviously he does the most unspeakable and very quick act of violence, which isn't on camera, due to that wish, ironically, which obviously is deliberate, to stay peaceful. So it's more than the numerous themes running through.
I mean, the main question with Albrecht is, to what extent is his apparent sort of altruistic motivations actually selfish? And again, without giving too much away, I like to think that we play with the trope of the good German by hopefully sort of at a few points provoking the question of, well, hold on, exactly why is he acting in this way?
And what would any of us do? I mean, you know, I tried to make sure that when we, you know, directing the actors, a lot of it was about, I think they're very good because they do manage to empathise in every moment, you know, in term, and justify what their actions are. Some extent, what Albrecht does, is it going to fundamentally change what happens to this man? I mean, you know, that's he could quite easily believe that whatever I do now, if he goes back to where he came from, what's going to happen? You know, is it going to be any different to the resolution I decide right now? You know,
well, he's going to be a soldier until if the war ended there and then, and he went back to Germany, he would be a soldier up until the crucial moment in the middle of the film with Michael Sheen. At that moment, he becomes a dictator of sorts, because he'll do anything to keep his community the way he wants it to be.
Yeah.
He changes completely. That is the moment when you lose any sympathy you had with the good
world. But
how
he justifies it to
himself,
I guess.
But he feels that he's probably saving more lives by doing that.
How did you go about directing Andrea Riseborough's character? Because she has to express a lot without actually giving very much away.
Andrea takes direction like a dream. You talk an idea through with her, and you talk about what... You just throw some ideas in there and she ingests them and just comes out with something. My first conversation with Andrea was about the style of film that I wanted to make, that we were trying to achieve. And, you know, we were talking about stillness. We were talking about... I mean, I told her that the camera will stay on you for times and we will do all we can to cut the dialogue down as much as possible. What I want to see is I want to see you behave. I want to see you react. And she's much happier if you cut dialogue. I mean, she'll do the dialogue. She knows it inside out. But as an actor, she's very much somebody who would prefer to do it with her eyes, with a stillness rather than a line. If she's done that, then I think that's an achievement. you know, I left the camera on her. I left the camera on a lot of the actors and just watched and waited until something changed. I gave them a lot of space in terms of performance, I think.
You mentioned budget.
Yeah.
Was it something you were constantly battling?
It's good to remember that when you're writing a script, you are aware of the kind of budget that you're writing into. And we were aware that that pushed us towards a certain kind of film, which we were very happy to do. And I suppose, because it's the first time that I'd written a script, I was just very interested how often that forced us to find inventive solutions, which I ended up genuinely preferring to what we had before, actually.
The freedom of having a low budget is that you can it forces you to be very clear about what you're doing, and I was very, very clear about the style of film we were making. And we worked quickly, 18 and a half setups a day, which is some going, 35mm in some remote locations, but it was challenging, but you know, I don't think we worried too much about it. Nothing major went wrong. Had something major gone wrong, perhaps we'd be having a different conversation now, but we were very focused on the story we wanted to tell. We didn't shoot loads and loads of footage. We shot specifically, you know, we told the story visually as we wanted to tell it.